Welcome to the Old Time Dragnet Show. This is your host, Adam Graham. Today's show is actually brought to you by listener Tom Williams, who generously just went ahead and sent in a very nice donation to the program. So thank you so much for bringing us this show, Tom. It's much appreciated. And if anybody's so inclined, we've added a donation link. We're not going to talk about it a whole lot, but if people are so inclined, there it is. All right, we got some, and the end of the show, we're going to have I've already recorded, actually, my end comments, so I'm recording my beginning comments after my end comments, just to make sure I get, you know, all the podcast alley comments that are included. And I actually, says, how much I enjoy the show, forward to hearing the beat, Mark, and iTunes. Before I do that, I want to give you our contact information. The show notes, dragnetradio.blogspot.com. Email your thoughts, adam@adamsweb.us. But somebody made the remarks over at Podcast Alley that you could get the first episode of Dragnet from a certain old-time radio place. It was thenradio.com. And I went ahead and I downloaded the episode that they had for sale, and it turned out not to be the first episode, but rather episode in the series, which was, of course, the one we call Nickel-Plated Gun, also called by some. That kind of gets confusing. So Nickel-Plated Gun makes more sense. They were very reasonable and, you know, gave a very nice, amicable exchange. They've corrected the error. They removed it from their catalog. But this comes from the fact that a lot of these, you know, radio sites, they buy their shows in bulk. So they have not listened to every single episode. I mean, there are several thousand in this site. But thenradio.com, they've got a lot of great shows, a lot of great episodes, a lot of great dragnets. They do not, however, have the first episode. That one, as far as we know, is lost. So if you happen to find it, please let somebody who knows what they're doing know, so that can get a good home, because I would love to hear it. And go ahead now, and we will turn to our episode today, The Big Betty. This one is actually a very good one you can get on television. The radio program has a little bit more detail, which is nice. And of course, I'm talking about the TV program that's available, the 1950s one. This one, you'll say you go into a dollar bin and you see a Walmart DVD Dragnet. This will be on, you know, if there's multiple DVDs in there, this one will be on there. And it's very well done in this episode. I like the extra details that were not in the TV version. It really does add something. So let's go ahead and take a listen to The Big Betty, and then we will be back with commentary with me and my pal David Oatney.
The story you are about to hear is true. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Fatima Cigarettes, best of all long cigarettes, brings you Dragnet.
You're a detective sergeant. You're assigned a bunco detail. A gang of petty swindlers has set up operations in your city. They're experienced, cunning. They work fast. Your job, get them.
Documented drama of an actual crime. For the next 30 minutes, in cooperation with the Los Angeles Police Department, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual case transcribed from official police files. From beginning to end, from crime to punishment, Dragnet is the story of your police force in action.
It was Tuesday, December 14th. It was cold in Los Angeles. We were working the day watch out of Bunco detail. My partner's Ben Romero. The boss is Captain McCauley. My name's Friday. It was 10:35 a.m. when I got to room 38, Bunco detail.
Joe?
Yeah, Ben.
Joe, this is Miss Bergstrom. You talked to her on the phone last night?
Oh, yeah, sure.
This is my partner, Sergeant Friday.
How do you do?
Glad to know you. Would you care to sit down?
Thank you. I was downtown, so I thought it'd be just as easy for me to come in and see you.
Did you bring those things with you, Miss Bergstrom?
Here they are. Wristwatch. Pen and pencil set.
Mm-hmm. Sure make them look nice, don't they?
On the outside, yeah.
Let me take the back off the watch for you. There. You can see for yourself, Sergeant.
That's junk. Not worth 15 cents.
He charged me $48 for that watch. Said it was wholesale. He wasn't making any profit on it. Told me he was doing it because he'd known Harry so well. Watch only ran for a day, then it stopped.
How about the pen and pencil set, miss?
Just bad. Pen's just a shell, won't even write. Same with the pencil. I paid him $30 for them.
Mm-hmm. This engraving on the pen was love from Harry.
That's Harry's boy I was engaged to. That's how the man got me interested to start with. Came to my house and gave them to me. The watch and the pen and pencil. Said Harry had ordered them as presents for me.
Mm-hmm.
I just had to cry when he brought them. Poor Harry.
When did this man come to your home, Miss Bergstrom?
Yesterday morning. Guess I should have been more careful, but I didn't think anybody would do a thing like that.
What kind of a story did he give you?
Well, he came to the door and told me his name was Spencer. He said Harry had ordered these things as presents for me, and Harry told him to deliver them to my house. Watch looked beautiful in the case. I didn't know anything was wrong.
I see. Would you go on, please?
He told me it was a special order. He said Harry had written him from overseas a week before. Harry was in the Marine Corps, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he said he hoped the engraving was all right. The way Harry wrote, he wanted it in his letter. I just couldn't take it. I cried.
This man, he pretended to be a close friend of Harry?
Yeah. That's why I showed him the letter. One from the Marine Corps, but Harry had been killed overseas.
When did you receive that letter, Miss Bergstrom?
2 days before, on Saturday. Harry's name was on the casualty list on Monday.
Yes, we understand. What did the man do when you showed him the letter?
He sympathized with me. Or he pretended to. I didn't think there was any trick. I didn't think anybody was that low. Pen and pencil set looked a little cheap, but I wanted them no matter how cheap they were. Harry's last present to me, that's what I thought.
How did he broach the idea of money?
Well, when he was ready to leave, he told me Harry had ordered the things on credit. Said he didn't want to mention it, but he wondered how I could get payment for the watch and the pen and pencil.
Well, he didn't show you a bill, did he? An invoice listing the price of the watch or the engraving that was done?
No. And I didn't want him bothering Harry's mother or father at a time like this. I borrowed some money from my dad and paid him.
Let's see, it's $48 for the watch, $30 for the pen and pencil set.
Yeah. He gave me a phone number to call if the watch needed adjustment, and when I found the watch was a fake, I called the number. It was a Chinese laundry. They didn't know anything about it.
You haven't seen or heard from this man since he left your house yesterday morning?
No.
Could you describe this man for us, Miss Bergstrom? What he looked like? Clothes he was wearing?
It's right here on this slip of paper, Sergeant. I wrote it all out for you.
Thank you.
Well, you're not alone. If that's any consolation, there's an army widow out in Hollywood who was cheated on the same kind of deal last Friday.
It's so cruel using a dead person's name to cheat you.
Yes, ma'am.
How can anybody get lower than that?
They keep trying. Ben and I took Miss Bergstrom's crime report. The phony watch and pen and pencil set were booked as evidence. In the past 2 weeks, we'd received a half a dozen identical complaints from relatives or friends of lately deceased persons. The swindler, or con man, as he likes to be called in his trade, gets the names of lately deceased persons from the obituary column or the military casualty list in the newspapers. Then he fixes up some cheap article of merchandise with appropriate engraving and calls on the friends and relatives of the deceased. He pretends to know nothing about the death of the person whom he claims placed the order for the merchandise. In almost every case, the friend or relative agrees to pay for the articles at some exorbitant price. For the con man, it's a lucrative racket. For the public, a vicious one. Wednesday, December 15th, Ben and I looked up an informant, a former con man.
What do you think of it, fellas? Been in business for 2 months, doing fine. What do you think of it?
Looks great, kid. Nice stuff.
Finest baby laundry in South Los Angeles. That's why I advertise. Hey, you don't think that's too broad, do you?
Oh, I don't think so, Judd. You got some nice equipment here. Baby laundry. How'd you ever get started?
Father-in-law set me up with a loan. Says he got tired of me trying to sell him bum watches.
Well, that's a good break for you, Judd. Say, you got a couple of minutes? We'd like to talk to you.
Sure thing. Come on back here.
Okay.
Fine, thanks.
Yeah, I'm squared away, living a solid life. Not bad at all, you know. It surprised me.
You ever see any of the old gang, Judd?
Not much, no. Some of the old grifters look me up now and then, try to touch me, and I'll go. Hey, here you are. Pull one up.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, fellas, what can I do for you?
Well, we'd like to know how close you got your ear to the ground, Judd. There's a gang of bunks in town. They're working hard.
What pitch are they using?
They're working the obits, the casualty lists. Thought maybe you might be able to help us.
I don't know. How long have you been gone?
Last couple of weeks. Had half a dozen reports on them.
That's one thing they never could tap me for. Obituary racket. Lousiest racket there is.
Can you do anything for us?
I heard one little rumble about it. 4 or 5 guys in the con mob. Is that right?
We know that, Judd. Where can we look for them?
Now, you know my position. When I quit the game, I quit. The only contacts I make are when some of the old boys come around for a touch.
Well, how much have you heard about the game?
What I said, there's 4 or 5 of them out of the Middle West, I think.
You got any idea at all where we could start looking?
Well, I can start checking for you. Have you nailed any of them yet?
We've got to find them before we can arrest them, Judd.
Yeah, well, as I say, when I quit the game, I quit. But maybe I can take a few soundings for you. Can't promise you anything. I'm strictly on the up and up.
Okay, Judd. You know where to get in touch with us. We'll appreciate anything you can do.
Yeah, well, you've helped me plenty of times, fellas. Wouldn't hurt a bit to tab that bunch. I'll walk out with you.
Yeah, see, you got all the machines going. The baby laundry business must be pretty good, huh?
It's a staple commodity, fellas. Kids always need a fresh change. Just a minute. Yeah, look at this. Just look at the size of it.
Yeah.
You ever see anything so small in your life? It's cute, huh?
Yeah, what is it?
New kind of soakers, I think. Let's see the label here. Yeah, Mother Greg Super Soakers. Kids think you sure give me a wallet, you know?
Hey, we might as well check the office while we're here, Ben. Can I use your phone, Judd?
Yeah, right over there on the wall. You got change?
Yeah, thank you. I have.
City Hall.
2572.
2572.
Bunko fugitive, Brian.
Joe Friday, Tom. Anything doing?
Yeah, Joe. I think we might have a lead on those bunks working the obituary racket.
What do you got?
They reached a woman in Highland Park. Where are you?
Baby laundry.
Oh. Well, it's a Mrs. Westerly. Her daughter was killed in an auto accident. Last night they came around and sold the woman a watch her daughter was supposed to have ordered. Also a necklace and pen and pencil set.
Mm-hmm.
$250. Usual gent.
You talked to this Mrs. Westerly?
Yeah, we took the report. The man's description, his M.O., the rest all match up.
What's the lead?
She watched the man when he left her house.
Yeah?
He got in a taxi cab.
10:30 a.m. While Sergeants Bryant and Ullery got out a broadcast on the suspect, Ben and I drove to the offices of the cab company where we contacted the special agent. He helped us check the waybills for the preceding night. On the waybill for cab 213, we found the trip listed. Starting point, the intersection nearest the Westerly home. Destination, a hotel on South Flower Street. We went to the hotel and interviewed the desk clerk. From the description we gave him, he identified the man as Fred G. Norris from Minneapolis. At least that's the way he'd signed the hotel register. The clerk told us Norris wasn't in. We had him show us Norris's room. In his suitcases, we found quantities of dime store costume jewelry, monogrammed, and 2 dozen cheap wristwatches and wallets and handbags done in poor quality imitation leather. Also a portable engraving set. The clerk told us that Norris was expected back shortly. We told him to say nothing to the suspect when he arrived. We called the office and arranged for a stakeout at the hotel. Then we we drove back to the office. 1 p.m. They told us Norris had been recognized from his description and picked up by Unit 17R on the way back to his hotel shortly before noon. Ben and I joined Sergeants Ullery and Bryant in the interrogation room where they were questioning the suspect. He looked about 40 years old, white, male American, about 6 feet tall, 170 pounds. He would admit nothing. Bryant kept questioning him.
You're wasting our time on your own, Norris. Face it. You were playing a rough game and you lost. Now, how about it?
You're going to feel pretty silly when you find out you got the wrong guy.
Who do you work for, Fred?
You can do what you want about investigating me. You haven't a thing to hold me on.
There's no use wasting any more time. You got that list of victims?
Yeah. These are the ones that Tad Norris...
Yeah. Thank you.
A couple more here, Joe.
Thanks, Jim. Hello, Miss Bergstrom there, please? Oh, this is Sergeant Friday, Miss Bergstrom, Bunko Detail. Yeah, we picked up a suspect. We'd like to see if you can identify him. Would it be all right if we sent a car out for you right now? All right, fine. Thank you very much. Bye.
Look, I can't sit here all day. I have business to attend to.
Right, Norris, he's on the phone.
Hello? Miss Cronin there, please. This is Sergeant Friday calling, Miss Cronin. Bunko Detail. Yes, ma'am, that's right. I'm sorry to disturb you, but we have a suspect in custody down here. Yes, ma'am?
Hey, Sergeant.
Could you come down to City Hall right away?
Sergeant.
Would you hold on just a minute, please? Thank you. Yeah, Norris?
You got me.
2:58 p.m. We informed the victims that the special show-up had been canceled. And we called in a stenographer and had her take Fred Norris' statement. In addition to listing the crimes he committed, he also told us that there were 6 men in the Bunko gang besides himself. He gave us the names and descriptions of each one of them. He stated that they'd been operating in Los Angeles for the past 4 months. Norris said that none of them had ever met the leader of their Bunko gang. The only contact they had with the leader was through one of the older gang members, a man by the name of Wesley Fisher. Before Norris was taken to Central Jail for booking, he gave us the address of the house where he had been living with the other gang members. Norris's information on the suspects was checked through R&I. We got one mate, Wesley Fisher. He had one prior arrest 2 years before on a grand theft charge, but he'd been released for lack of evidence. 3:15 p.m., together with Sergeants Ullery and Bryant and 2 men from Metro Squad, we drove out to the address given us by Fred Norris. Turned out to be a neat-looking bungalow in the West Hollywood area.
Take the front door, Joe.
Yeah. Say, Tom.
Yeah?
You want to have Johnson and Brewer cover the back of the place, please?
Okay, Joe. Maureen and I will cover the side.
Thanks. Let's go, man.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to get a deal on you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you want to check for the termites now? I'm Mrs. Callahan, the owner.
No, ma'am. We want to see the tenants.
Well, I'm afraid you're a little late.
Is that so?
You are listening to Dragnet, authentic stories of your police force in action.
Wednesday, December 15th, 4 p.m. We made a thorough check of the house, which the 6 suspects had just vacated. We found nothing that would help us. We talked to the owner of the house where the suspects had been living. She told us that she'd rented the place furnished to them about 3 months before. She identified Wesley Fisher's mugshot, but she told us that he'd used the name of Charles Wilder. She also recognized each of the other gang members from the descriptions that Fred Norris had given us. She told us that while they were living there, the men seemed to keep odd hours and that they had a car. She told us that she'd taken the license number of the car the day the men moved in. The number was checked with DMV. It was registered in the name of Wesley Fisher, 1008 California Street. It's a transient hotel. The manager told us Fisher had moved about 9 months ago. There was no forwarding address. We got out an all-points bulletin on Wesley Fisher, requesting that all occupants in his car be held for investigation of grand theft. Thursday, December 16th, 8 a.m. Ullery, Bryant, Ben, and I met with Captain McCauley.
Where are they getting all this junk they're palming off? Where's their source of supply?
The guy we picked up, Norris, told us they brought a good supply of it out with them from the Middle West.
That hotel room Norris had downtown, they were using that for a warehouse. They didn't want to keep the stuff at the house they were living in.
How are they hitting? Any possibility of stakeouts?
No, not unless we cover every name in the
columns.
You might have to try it. Something's got to be done. Look at these. Two more this morning. Straight out of the obituary column.
Mm-hmm. Took one family for $90. Another one for $60.
How about that last run through the stats office? Help you any?
They pulled some more mugs for us. We're going to show them to the victims this morning.
How about this Norris? Think he's come up with everything?
We were up talking to him again at county jail yesterday. Didn't have anything new, Skipper.
We dropped in at the sheriff's bunco detail. They've got one new case, same M.O. Description comes close to one of the guys. The victim was the father of a Navy flyer lost overseas. They sold him a gold watch chain that his son was supposed to have bought him for a present. Solid brass.
The sheriff's men got anything new?
Well, we've been working pretty close with him. Nothing new.
Excuse me. Bunco fugitive, Captain McCauley.
May I talk to Joe Friday?
Oh, yeah. Hold on. You,
Friday. Oh, thank you. Yeah?
Joe, this is Judd. Can you meet me out of my place?
What do you got?
Name Wesley Fisher mean anything to you?
8:30 a.m. Ben and I drove out and met with Judd at his home. He was still in his bathrobe when he met us at the door. He told us he had an important appointment downtown at 9 o'clock and he was in a hurry. We talked to him while he shaved.
Hope you fellas don't mind. Can't miss this date. Lining up some new business, you know.
It's all right, Judd. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I gotta move fast on these things before they cool, you know.
Well, what's the thing with us, Judd? What's the story?
Well, I don't know what's worse. Brother Max called me this morning. Remember my brother Max, don't you?
No, I don't think so.
I watched the Pink Parrot Bar in South Maine. When you were in to see me the other day about those grifters you want, I gave my brother a tumble on it. Told him to keep an eye open. I hand that to Ollie.
Oh, yeah. Here you go.
Thanks. They're all steamed up.
What'd Max come up with?
Well, he's night bartender at the Parrot, you know. Now, last night he spotted a couple of guys at the bar. Had some day-old newspapers.
Uh-huh.
They were sitting there with the papers turned to the obituary column, checking off names, writing down addresses. Max is pretty sharp that way. Spotted him right off. Lousy razor.
Does Max know these two men he spotted?
No, not by name, but he knew the one who lived in the hotel next door to the bar. When the hotel night clerk came in for a beer, Max asked him about it. He tabbed one of the guys as Wesley Fisher.
Did he have anything on the other man?
No, the clerk told Max he doesn't live at the hotel, but spends a lot of time there with Fisher.
Well, had he seen Fisher and this other guy at the bar before?
Yeah, Max says he'd been in before. Got lashed up a couple times.
Mm-hmm. Say, would it be okay to contact your brother at his home, Judd?
Sure.
We don't want to contact him at the bar.
Yeah, sure thing. Get his address as soon as I'm finished here. He just moved.
Okay.
I know. Hope I can get you guys out here for nothing.
We appreciate it, Judd. Looks good.
Seems to fit. That hotel down there, it's a hangout con, man. Angles are all there.
Let's hope Fisher is. 8:53 a.m. We arrived at the hotel on South Main Street. We checked with the desk clerk, who told us that Wesley Fisher had room 37. As far as he knew, Fisher was in his room. We got a passkey from the clerk and went up to room 37, where we found Fisher and another man. He identified himself as Raymond Breen, one of the gang members identified by Fred Norris. We also found a small supply of cheap watches and pen and pencil sets in Fisher's car. It was parked near the hotel, was impounded. We took both suspects back to the city hall. We questioned them separately in the interrogation room. Breen was first, but he refused to answer our questions. He was taken back to the squad room and Wesley Fisher was brought in.
Sit down, Fisher.
Thank you.
Guess you know why you're here.
No, I haven't the least idea.
All right, then we'll show you. Do you know Fred Norris?
Fred Norris. Name sounds a little familiar. Can't quite place it.
He places you pretty well. He says he worked with you and Breen up till a couple of days ago.
That's so?
Yeah. Says he lived with you in that bungalow out in West Hollywood.
That's so. Norris, West Hollywood. When was that?
2 days ago, Fisher. Your landlady identified your mugs. He even had the license number of your car.
What's it prove, gentlemen?
Proves you're lying. You and Breen worked together. You did work with Norris. You're part of one of the filthiest rackets going.
Gentlemen, you're making a bad mistake.
No, no, there's no mistake, Fisher. Your picture's been identified by at least a half a dozen victims. Now, you can go on playing coy all you want, but we can prove that the pen and pencil sets that you sold some of the victims are identical to the ones we found in your car.
I haven't any idea what you're talking about. Believe me, that's the truth.
You wouldn't know the truth if it followed you, mister. Now, look, maybe you're great at conning old men and young girls, but don't try to pass any of it here.
Now, just a moment.
Now, you listen, you two-bit thief. I couldn't begin to tell you off of the rotten things you've been pulling off in this town for the past 3 months. That young girl who lost her boyfriend overseas, that widow out in Hollywood, the old man in Highland Park whose wife passed away. You must have felt pretty sharp cheating them out of a few bucks. Maybe you don't remember, mister, but we do and they do. And you're going to pay for them.
You all through?
I'm through, Fisher. You're just starting.
I have nothing further to say, gentlemen. You can talk to my lawyer.
We'll give him your new address.
Yes.
County jail. Suspects Wesley Fisher and Raymond Breen were booked and transported to the county jail. Both of them were positively identified by the victims. Warrants were obtained for the three suspects, Norris, Fisher, and Breen. They were arraigned and held to answer at a preliminary hearing on several counts of grand theft. During the next 2 weeks and through the Christmas holidays, identical complaints of bunco operations continued to come in. Friends and relatives of lately deceased persons were still being victimized. The gang's operations continued as usual. There was only one change. The crime report showed that a woman was now operating in the obituary racket along with the male suspects. Christmas came and went. On New Year's Eve, Ben and I were assigned to standby duty. A few minutes before 8 p.m., we got a call from the county jail that Wesley Fisher wanted to see us. Went to the 10th floor of the jail interview room.
I'm not going to take all the heat. They're in just as deep as I am. If they can't do right by me, I'll square it up myself. I'll tell you everything I know.
Go ahead, Fisher. What is it?
Her name's Betty McGraw. She's the one you've been looking for. The whole idea was hers. She planned it out. She got everybody together. It was her show.
Where can we find her?
213 Foster, apartment 8.
Wesley Fisher gave a complete statement of all his crimes and also implicated the other members. He told us Betty McGraw was his girlfriend. She'd come up with the idea for the obituary racket. She gathered the men together for the job, and it had been planned that she was to stay in the background. In case of trouble, she would furnish aid to the gang members in the form of bail bond money and lawyers. She received a percentage of the take from each of the gang members. We checked her through R&I. She had a criminal history dating back 11 years. We obtained her mugshot. 10:30 p.m., we went out to the address Fisher gave us. A maid answered the door. She told us that the McGraw woman was not there, that she'd gone to a New Year's Eve celebration at a downtown hotel. It was 11:15 when we got there. We identified ourselves to the special officer at the hotel and showed him the mugshot of Betty McGraw. He thought he'd seen her at the main bar. We started looking.
Sure do pack them in.
Yeah. Say, excuse me, please. Can I get through here? Thank you.
Sorry, excuse me. Hey, Joe, over this way. I think we can get through.
Okay, do you see her yet?
No, they're jammed in there. I can't see a thing. But... Hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Can you see down at the end of the bar there?
Where?
In the black dress?
Oh, yeah. That's her.
Would you let her through here, please? Excuse me. Sorry.
Joe? Right behind you.
Is your name Betty McGraw? Is your name Betty McGraw?
Yeah, Betty McGraw. I don't know you. Who are you?
Police officer. We'd like to see you outside.
Outside? I'm standing here. This is where the party is. Right here.
Let's go, lady. Outside.
Is there a bar outside? I didn't know there was a bar outside.
Okay, Ben.
Come on, lady.
I don't know you at all.
No use trying to get through this. We'll have to wait.
Yes. Well, Happy New Year, Joe.
Yeah, same to you.
Maybe next year we'll have it off.
I don't know why. I always cry when I hear that song. No reason, I just cry.
Yeah?
Every year, I play it and I cry. No reason at all.
You got one this year, lady. Come on.
Change to protect the innocent.
On March 28th, trial was held in Superior Court, Department 93, City and County of Los Angeles, State of California. In a moment, the results of that trial. The remaining members of the Bunco gang were apprehended and brought to trial. All of them, including the gang leader, Elizabeth McGraw, were tried and convicted of grand theft, They are now serving their terms in the state penitentiary. You have just heard Dragnet, a series of authentic cases from official files. Technical advice comes from the Office of Chief of Police W.H. Parker, Los Angeles Police Department.
Fatima Cigarettes, the best of all long cigarettes, has brought you Dragnet, portions transcribed from Los Angeles.
Coming up, We the People, then Screen Directors Playhouse on NBC.
Welcome back. It was quite a fascinating episode. We have with us my pal David Oatney of World According to Oatney and Oatney on the Air. David, it's been quite a while since we had you, and it's good to have you here to talk about and provide some guest commentary on this episode.
Thanks a lot, Adam. I really enjoy old-time radio and Dragnet in particular, and I especially enjoyed this episode. As you said, it was a really fascinating one.
Yeah, I know. This is one of those episodes you just don't see anymore because usually to merit being on TV, it's got to be a homicide or something sensational. But this is, almost in a way educational because we're a lot more likely to, have somebody try and pull something like this on us than we are to have, some bizarre stalker or homicide thing happen in our lives.
Well, that's exactly right. This is the kind of thing that police departments all over the country and of every shape and size deal with on some level every day. Now, obviously what happened in the episode was terrible. People running around looking in the obituary pages, finding who had died or who, in a lot of cases, had terrible tragedy happen to their lives. Soldiers dying on the casualty list and things like that, and going in and scamming people, right, for money, saying they ordered things that they didn't, the things turned out to be cheap imitation things, things that didn't work, pen and pencil sets that didn't write, watches that didn't tick, that kind of thing. And, but believe it or not, these are the kinds of cases that the police deal with on an everyday basis. I think that our modern television dramas, even though I enjoy some of them, CSI and Law and Order are particular favorites of mine in today's world, but the biggest problem with those dramas is that they don't really give us an insight into real police work, daily basis kind of police work. Radio Dragnet did that. Why? Well, at the beginning of the episode, what does it always say? The story you are about to hear is true.
Exactly.
The names have been changed to protect the innocent. These were true stories. These are things that happened, in the Los Angeles Police Department back in the day. This was before DNA and before you could just assume that you'd be able to find who did this by testing, for example, the pen and pencil sets for DNA. These people had to do hard police work, and the poor victims had to go down and file reports with no assurance that the police would be able to find who did this. And in fact, I think a lot of times people on the other end of the spectrum assume the police aren't doing the work when in fact they are. It's just, as we learned in this episode, sometimes very difficult to apprehend who would scam people like this, and this is the kind of routine work most police departments do. And if you recall in the episode, the lady really behind it all, they didn't get her till the very end.
Yeah,
she was not a major player in all this till the end of the episode.
Yeah, and the thing too is it took months to get this done. I think Webb did a good job. I think it says something for the talent of Jack Webb, because to be honest, anybody can make a tantalizing murder interesting. it takes, I think, took a very special talent to take these, you know, average cases and turn them into, you know, real dramas that people would like to watch and listen to. And, of course, this was later made into a TV episode by the same name. This really does show the true talent of Webb to really make this an interesting.
Well, it really does show Webb's talent to make what would be mundane police work in an ordinary police department something that the average citizen would be interested in. This is the kind of work that police do on a daily basis in every police department in America. When we, I think our modern crime dramas, as good as some of them are, as bad as some others are, they tend to concentrate on the most horrific of crimes. But the police on a daily basis in the smallest town or the largest city like Los Angeles, your average cop doesn't see a murder a day, but he does see theft. He does see con artists. He does see con artists engaging in theft, such as we saw in this episode. And what Webb had the ability to do, really, was to take that and show the average citizen, maybe who might have been the victim of something similar. This is the kind of police work that goes into a case like what you'd see on a daily basis.
Well, I think
make us all interested in that.
And I think, too, it kind of comes back to really, getting up the moral outrage about the situation. I know in a lot of dramas, the con man kind of gets winked at, in compared to some of the other characters. You can certainly understand the con man's not the biggest fish, but I think he really brings home the victims in this episode. And I also like the scene where they had the guy and they were going to, and he was refusing to cop out. And, he just stood up, sat there right in front of him and started calling up all the victims to tell them to come down.
Come down and identify this person.
And, at some point he goes, okay, I'll just go ahead and confess.
Right, which, the police do still engage in those kinds of tactics. But, you don't. And that's much easier to do than have to do DNA swabs and anything like that. Call up those who claim to be the victim of this person who gave you their name, and get them down there to identify them, person after person after person.
Yeah.
And, that's good detective work. And I think that's what Webb was highlighting, really, in this episode. This was good old-fashioned detective work from the very beginning of this case, and if you follow the case from the beginning of the episode to the end, like you said, it took months to do. It was New Year's Eve by the time they got around to arresting one of the real principals in the entire business.
But it was worth it for that zinger at the end. I cry for no reason. Well, this year you got a reason.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of funny. More than a little funny, actually. This year you have a reason, come on. And the funny thing about it, though, was that we don't hear much about her. The episode was named after her, but we don't hear much about her.
Wow. Well, part of that is that some of these episode titles may have come from later on, in some cases. But it was amazing in that way because it was about the crimes, it was about the process. But all right, well, I see we are actually about out of time. So, David, I thank you for joining me and for providing your commentary. I encourage everybody to check out the blog, dragnetradio.blogspot.com. And email me your thoughts, adam@adamsweb.us. But for now, I thank everybody so much for listening, and David so much for joining us. This is Adam Graham, signing off.